lectures. This is the 19th Archie Cochrane lecture. And I'd like to say a few words about Archie. He was a remarkable man with a lot of common sense and a lot of kindness. And he saw the 1930s, he saw treatment of patients in the 1930s, he saw prisoner of war conditions in the 1940s, and he just became, as he when he came back, he wanted to get back into some kind of a normal life. It was very difficult after the disruptions of the Second World War. And as he was thinking about medicine, he was just more and more uncertain as to whether any of the treatments did any good at all. You know, if you were going to treat a TB patient, you know, should you let air into their chest to collapse a lung? Would it make them any more likely to live? And he'd sort of got memories of all these dramatic treatments that used to be done in Gower Street in the London teaching hospitals in the 1930s. And then he'd been a prisoner of war camp, being a doctor of TB patients who he couldn't give these treatments to. And it seemed to him that the proportion he got better was roughly the same as the proportion he used to get better when in the London hospitals. It wasn't obviously different. And he just got to thinking, well, how can we possibly know what's true? How many, there's some obvious things. If you don't set a broken bone straight, then, you know, after it's been broken, then the leg will finish up permanently twisted. You can recognise things like that when there's a big effect. And this is the hospital where penicillin, or at least it was before they knocked it down, where penicillin first got given to humans. And that has such a huge effect. I mean, when we were first down here, the doctors had given it was still around. They just said it was just extraordinary. They'd just never seen infections melting away like that. It was something completely out of anything they'd ever seen before. By the time it's happened to about two or three patients on the trot, then you think this is something really, you know that it's real. You know this is a cause and effect relationship. But then it got to be, there are so many questions in medicine where the question is, are you affecting the probability of getting better? It's not this will cure you or this won't make any difference. Is it affecting the probability? And there just seemed to be no way of sorting out whether treatments would affect the probability of getting better, if the effect wasn't very big. And he actually got, maybe for that and for other reasons, really quite depressed about the subject of how could he ever know whether anything you were doing was of any use at all. And finished up turning to epidemiology, which actually isn't an answer. And then Bradford Hill came along, and they randomised whether or not to give streptomycin to TB patients, and the allocation was at random, and there was just definitely, you didn't know who you were going to get, who was going to benefit, but there was clearly a substantial difference in the proportion who got better. The ones who got the real drug were a lot more likely to get better than the ones who didn't. Therefore the drug on average worked. It didn't work for everybody, but it wasn't a necessary cause of getting better, it wasn't a sufficient cause of getting better, but it was an important cause of getting better. And at the same time, and Archie said it was like as a blinding revelation to him. Suddenly, randomisation was the key to everything. In fact, it was a bit of a cheat because streptomycin was so good that would have been recognised as well without randomisation. But anyway, that was the thing that illustrated the principle. And he felt that Bradford Hill, who'd introduced the idea of randomisation, at least to was the most recent to introduce it. I believe it was first introduced, according to Ian Chalmers, in 1835 by Germans testing homeopathy. But it was introduced, and partly because it was introduced in association with wonderful new treatments, penicillin, streptomycin, and so on, vaccination against polio, it really took off. That was the moment when it took off, and we're all sort of downstream from that takeoff. And as a result, we've been able to study things where the differences between one thing and another aren't very big, but where the treatments apply to millions of people. And where you can get definite evidence that then changes the treatments of millions of people and does save a lot of lives. I've just remembered I turned my mobile phone off. Everybody else do the same. Anyway, so Archie went on to be the high priest of randomised trials. But he actually wasn't very good at doing randomised trials, but that doesn't matter because he made up for that with his enthusiasm. And when he died, he left quite a lot of money to Green College, which Green College has now spent, there's actually nothing left of it, but which also saw the foundation of this series of lectures. And so since over the last 20 years or so, there's been a lecture every year. Generally, it roughly alternates between something to do with randomisation one year and then something mainly to do with epidemiology the next year or the previous year. But it's not a strict rule. It's just got to be something that Archie should have been interested in had he still been alive. And certainly the question about lowering cholesterol substantially really was of considerable interest to him. He, you know, he'd seen countries where heart disease was really rare. He knew it didn't have to be common. And was it cholesterol or wasn't it? It was argued, and the question was completely unsettled at the time when Archie died in the 1980s. Anyway, Colin Bagent, who's giving today's Cochrane lecture on lowering cholesterol substantially, he spent the whole of the 1980s getting himself educated here at Oxford. First as a mathematician, then after he'd finished his maths degree and wanted to do something more obviously useful, as a medical doctor. And then after he'd been a clinician for a few years, he met me and Rory Collins and switched to medical research. And for the last 20 years, he's been working with us in Oxford in the Clinical Trials Service Unit, using both his mathematics and his medicine to generate really reliable, large-scale, randomised evidence about things like aspirin and statins. Actually, Archie Cochrane was one of the co-investigators on one of the first serious trials of aspirin, but it wasn't big enough, and they got an inconclusive answer. I remember discussing that with him at some length. But anyway, now we've got serious evidence, and results are coming out of the work of Colin and others in the Vascular Overview Group, and in many places around the world, that affect how millions of people are treated. Archie Cochrane would have loved it. Now, Colin enjoyed not only maths and medicine, but also music, and I first met him at the house of my son's music teacher in Jericho. That time, Colin still looked young and hopeful, so you can see what work at the CTSU has done to him over the past 20 years. Anyway, Professor Colin Bagent, who is middle-aged, the 2011 Cochrane Lecture on what he's learnt over the last 20 years about the effects of lowering cholesterol substantially. Professor Bajan.
Thank you very much, Richard. I'm sure it could have been worse than that. But thank you very much for that introduction. What I'm going to talk about tonight, you very definitely cannot get from non-randomised studies. So pretty much from here on, it's all about randomisation. The first chat I'm going to show you, this is a case study of a person who was seen in a New York clinic with a cholesterol level you can see in the top right-hand corner. And the question he wanted to know was, how much lower than this should my cholesterol be? And I hope that by the end of the hour or so, I will be able to tell you a little more about what the answer to that question is. So I'm going to start with some preliminaries from observational studies. This is going back some years now. We know from this study among 350,000 American men, that there's a relationship between cholesterol and the risk of coronary heart disease. And this relationship is what we would call log linear. So for every 1 millimole, which is the unit of measurement of cholesterol, 1 millimole higher cholesterol, your risk of coronary heart disease roughly doubles. And this is a relationship that holds right the way through the range of usual cholesterol that one finds in the population. And there's no level within this range where going lower doesn't associate with lower risk. But we were interested now in much lower levels of cholesterol, and so if we look in a Chinese study that was done by one of our colleagues, Daniel Chen and Richard Peter, many years ago, you see a similar relationship going right down to fairly low levels of cholesterol. These are Chinese people in Shanghai, and in those days their diet was very basic, they didn't have much saturated fat consumption. So right down to low levels, we see this same log linear relationship where each increment in cholesterol results in a similar proportional increase in the risk of coronary heart disease. Now, the early trials were trying to capitalize on this idea that since the relationship was log linear throughout the range that had been studied, right down to very low levels, perhaps lowering cholesterol would reduce the risk of coronary heart disease. But the early trials used absolutely feeble drugs. Some of the drugs were quite nasty to take. And the trial evidence actually produced quite conflicting and confusing results. So, for example, there were some drugs or dietary regimens that resulted in reductions in cholesterol of only about 5 to 10%. And even when you put all the trials together, some of which were positive, some of them were negative, they were zigzagging all over the place, you still only got what was regarded at that time as unconvincing evidence of benefit in terms of reductions in coronary heart disease. Even with the more powerful regimens, reducing cholesterol by 10 to 15%, this evidence of a reduction in coronary heart disease risk, even though perhaps now looking back it should have been persuasive, did not convince doctors on the whole that reducing cholesterol reduced the risk of disease. And one of the reasons for that was this, that as we now know by the play of chance, it turned out that in these early trials there was an excess of risk of non-coronary diseases. So if we look at these different types of diseases, you can see in each row the non-coronary vascular disease, then there was an excess, a slight excess in the cholesterol-lowering group. The cancer, again, there was a slight excess, nothing dramatic, but all taken together resulted in this overall excess, which, according to the rules of the statisticians, reached a level that was regarded as being unattributable to the play of chance. So this was regarded as being a problem, not only by the statisticians working on it, but also by the papers. We had headlines like this frequently in the newspapers about how taking cholesterol-lowering tablets would damage your health. And when I came to Oxford in 1991, I remember we were right in the middle of trying to address this issue. And Rory and Richard were trying to get funding for the what turned out to be the heart protection study. There was a real need for clarity around the question of whether lowering cholesterol could reduce the risk of disease. At that time, Michael Oliver was a very eminent doctor. He wrote in The Lancet, I'm not going to read this out, but he opined that there was a considerable possibility that hypercholesterolemia, high cholesterol, would increase the risk of death from non-cardiac causes, and reducing hypercholesterolemia would increase the risk of non-cardiac death. So this whole environment was very, very difficult at that time. And what happened to change all that was that statins came along, a new class of drugs which were much more effective at lowering cholesterol than previous regimens that had been available. And these new drugs, statins, which inhibit an enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase, could reduce cholesterol by around a third or even more in some cases. And so they were able to provide a much better test of the idea that lowering cholesterol would be effective. If you remember a few slides ago, I showed you regimens that could reduce cholesterol by maybe 5 to 10% or even 15%. Now we had drugs that could reduce cholesterol by double that. And so you can see that there's a much better prospect for testing the hypothesis that reducing cholesterol, according to the epidemiology, would be an effective way of reducing the risk of coronary heart disease. So in the late 1980s, there began a number of trials looking at this question. They were quite large trials for the time, and so they were regarded as being promising, and they would reliably address the question of that we've been talking about. Here's some examples of the sorts of drugs I'm talking about. Some of these include drugs that are now available. So the early ones included pravastatin, 40 milligrams daily, reduces bad cholesterol. I'll talk about that in a moment, but bad cholesterol, a bit of cholesterol that's bad for you, it's reduced by around a third by 40 milligrams daily. Simvastatin does it a bit more than that, 40 milligrams. It's a popular drug regimen now used. And these newer drugs, which in lower doses do similar things and can be used in much higher doses, that I'll come to. Just hopefully this won't put off the non-scientists too much, but it's really just a simple diagram of how cholesterol is managed within the body. We need cholesterol in our cells for cells to function. They have to have cholesterol. Mm-hmm. The cholesterol is processed by being absorbed from dietary fat into the bloodstream. It starts off as fairly big particles, and then it's whittled down into smaller and smaller particles until it gets to LDL cholesterol. Now, it also, in the liver, cholesterol is synthesized by the liver and is passed into the bloodstream as big particles, again, processed down to LDL or bad cholesterol. So statins act by stopping the, or impairing the translation of various substances into cholesterol by inhibiting this enzyme here, and that has the effect of reducing the production of what's called VLDL cholesterol, so particles in the bloodstream which contain cholesterol that are a certain size, and that as a result, or in a related process, leads to greater uptake by the liver of LDL or bad cholesterol. So the net impact of statin drugs is to reduce the level of LDL cholesterol in the blood. And that's the key process that we're talking about. Now, when we started off, I mean, I joined the unit the year before, we realised that actually, even if these few studies, and there were a handful now of studies that were ongoing with cholesterol-lowering drugs, particularly with statins, even if they all reported their findings and, you know, reported positive findings, there were still going to be substantial uncertainties about the effects of lowering cholesterol. And one particular problem that we anticipated was that we would not know from these studies alone whether there was any significant increase in the risk of non-coronary mortality. And we had to know that the environment at that time was so divisive that it was absolutely essential that we would be able to say, once these trials were reported, that yes, there was a reduction in coronary heart disease, but there was no accompanying increased risk of non-coronary and non-vascular death. And so a group of trialists got together in 1992 in conjunction with colleagues in Sydney, and we formed something called the Cholesterol Treatment Trialist Collaboration. And we've been meeting every year since that time. And the purpose of the collaboration has been to bring together the individual data from the trials that have been reported to try to process the data in a way that is much more informative than it would be just if it was available to doctors in individual published records. And what we did, it's quite an unusual thing at the time, is we published a protocol before we'd seen any of the results of the trial, so that we could be completely unbiased about the way in which we set up our analysis. And that was quite unusual. A lot of people now are thinking about doing that, but it meant that we could, before any results had been reported, set out what we would analyse. We only included the large trials. A lot of small trials were being conducted, but they didn't really give very much information. What we're interested in was keeping our work streamlined by just having the trials that involved at least 1,000 patients with 2 or more years of follow-up. These were the big trials that were producing lots of vascular events, lots of heart attacks and strokes that could be analysed. As I say, we published the protocol, and then in the first cycle of our analyses, which actually took quite a long time to do, much longer than I had realised, otherwise I probably wouldn't have got involved if I'd realised how much work it was going to be. It was 2005 before we actually published our first findings. But during that time, all these different statins had come onto the market and were being tested. And I do want to emphasise the importance. This is an unusual situation in medicine, actually. Here we had a successful class of drugs that were developed, a number of which were developed by different companies, and they all started conducting big trials, many of which were on their own big enough to show clear findings. And this has resulted in a really unusually large data set, and an unusually reliable data set that we're able to draw inferences from. So looking at these studies, the names don't matter all that much, but they're done in a range of different types of patients, a range of different doses, a range of different levels of starting cholesterol. And so there's a great deal of heterogeneity in the design of these studies. And what we asked people to do was to send us a standard format of data, so information about the patients themselves, each single patient, what they were allocated to by the randomization, and then what happened to them afterwards in terms of heart attacks and strokes and cancers and deaths. And it, a lot of detail was requested. And by and large, we've been very successful at getting the information pretty much from every trial. And so during that time, at least when we published the data in 2005, we had this much information. And compared to the very small numbers I was showing you in the first few slides, you can see that we're now in a different league. Now we have 14,000, or in 2005 we had 14,000 what we call major vascular events, which we're going to define as a heart attack or dying from coronary disease, having a replumbing of your coronary arteries, revascularization, or having a stroke. One of those events constitutes a major vascular event. You can see that the 14,000 major vascular events made up of 8,000 coronary events, 6,000 coronary revascularizations or replumbings, 3,000 strokes, and some people obviously have more than one of those, and they can add up to 14,000. We also had 5,000 cancers and 8,000 deaths. Now, this is a huge data set. In fact, you know, the numbers of events are more than some of the trials have patients. So it's really, really very important. And this is a key slide. This is one that's very, very important to grasp. What we're seeing here is 14 statin trials I showed you on the previous slide. And on this y-axis, what you're looking at is the size of the proportional reduction in risk of major vascular events. So if you had a quarter reduction, it would be about here, 25%. Quarter reduction, actually that's HPS, one of the trials run from CTSU. And that resulted from an LDL reduction, or bad cholesterol reduction, of around about 1.3. So what you see here is that the smaller the reduction in each of these trials, 1 point for each trial, the smaller the reduction in LDL cholesterol, the smaller the reduction in the risk of a major vascular event seen in each trial. So the larger trials, the trials involving a larger reduction in LDL cholesterol, like this one, which was actually the first one to report from Scandinavian patients with coronary disease, had a very large LDL reduction and got a very clear result, third reduction in coronary disease. But the point is that the larger the reduction in LDL cholesterol in each of these different trials, the bigger the result they got. Now, does this mean that the more you reduce cholesterol in the patient, the better? Well, it could be that some of these trials had different types of patients. So it may be that this particular trial had a large LDL reduction, but also patients were particularly likely to benefit. So you can't really say that just from this relationship alone. That requires a separate confirmation in trials that compare people with a standard dose for statin and a higher dose for statin. So you need to take individual patients and randomize them to more or less cholesterol reduction. But just sticking with this evidence for the moment, I know this is a very busy slide, and you can almost squint at it, actually, to see what it really means. But for those who haven't seen these types of slides before, that there, down the middle, the solid line, ending in a 1, is the line of no effect. So anything that falls on that line suggests that the particular thing being measured is not influenced by cholesterol lowering therapy. If treatment is better, it's on the left of the line, or your right of the line, or your left rather of the line. So these big squares here suggest that this is very, very good evidence of benefit. So what we're doing is we're looking at major vascular events and subdividing them by the different types of events. So major coronary events, there are about 7,000 of them, very clear evidence that reduction in risk is real. But remember the slide I showed you showing that relationship between LDL reduction and proportional reduction. That suggests that if there are different types of LDL reductions in different trials, we ought to correct for that difference in LDL reduction. So instead of presenting it just as an LDL risk reduction, we ought to say, well, how big is the reduction per 1 millimole reduction in LDL cholesterol? That's the only way to put all these trials on a similar playing field. So when we show these results in terms of the effects per 1 millimole LDL cholesterol reduction, we see that actually the effects are similar, not only on coronary disease, but also on replumbing of the coronary arteries, and also on ischemic stroke. By that I mean a stroke that's caused by a blood clot. Interestingly, it's not the same for hemorrhagic stroke, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But as I say, you can almost squint at that and see that very similar effects per minimal reduction in bad cholesterol throughout the different types in the brain, in the heart, in the coronary vessels when you recon them. Because we had what we call individual patient data, which is detailed data on each patient, we were able to split this and look to say, well, okay, well, what's the effect in, say, a patient who just had an MI, a heart attack? What is the effect in a patient who's young, less than 65? And I think that's a reasonable definition of being young. Male, female, and so on. You can subdivide the data very substantially. But one particular one we're very interested in is the effect different at different levels of LDL cholesterol, bad cholesterol? If you have a normal cholesterol or a low cholesterol, does reducing that low cholesterol give you benefit? Now remember, this was the first cut of the data. We did this in 2005. And so LDL cholesterols of less than 3.5, if you just remember that benchmark, 3.5, were not that unusual. But even at that low level, further reduction of LDL cholesterol conferred clear benefit. This is massively significant in terms of statistical terms. It is real. And this was really quite revolutionary at the time, because the idea had grown up, probably still exists to some extent, that you only really benefit from cholesterol lowering if your cholesterol is high. But this turned everything on its head, as some of the trials were originally done when they were originally reported. It said, if you are at high risk of a heart attack or a stroke, but your cholesterol is normal or even low, it being lower would be good for you. That was what that suggested. Now, this is a very nice slide. It was made by John Emerson, who's in the audience in some way, just showing you what's happened over the years to reducing cholesterol. So these are the early trials here. In those days, in the early years, people only got into these trials if they had high cholesterol. That was the group of patients. Patients with occurring events who had high cholesterol got into these trials. And as time went by, it became clear that these patients did benefit. The starting level of cholesterol gradually got lower and lower and lower. Until recently, it's been very low. And then more recently, the question has been asked, well, if you get down to a lowish level with a standard dose of a statin, would it still be beneficial to reduce LDL cholesterol still lower? And this is the group of trials that we're going to talk about now, the five trials that have asked that question by comparing a more intensive versus a less intensive dose of a statin. These are the trials. Again, names don't really matter very much, but what does matter is they all have compared a more intensive statin regimen versus a less intensive statin regimen. And in general, the starting LDL cholesterol in each of these trials on the standard regimen has been relatively low. So we're now testing a question: if you've got low cholesterol, does reducing it still further give you benefit? And now I'm showing you the results from the most recent update of the CTT collaboration. So this was published last year in The Lancet. And it's this overall slide, I think, quite nicely summarizes what we found. So the first thing we did was we updated our analysis from 2005. So there were a number of trials that had compared a statin versus control. And typically they've been done in populations that were not considered to be mainstream, or at least there was some doubt about whether lowering cholesterol in those populations would be beneficial. So, for example, there are quite a few patients being randomised into trials of patients with heart failure, patients with renal failure, patients who just had diabetes. So we updated that, and what we found was that if you reduce cholesterol by just over a millimol, then you reduce the risk by around 22%. And then each of the next five plots coming up are individual trial results from the five trials comparing a more intensive regimen versus a less intensive regimen. If you draw a line through that, then the slope of that line tells you the relationship. It's exactly the same as I showed you before on the white slide that I showed you with the relationship between LDL lowering and the proportional reduction. It's very, very similar relationship, even though five of the points are being provided by trials that have compared more versus less. So what we're seeing is, it doesn't matter where you are on that line, that risk relationship, lowering it gives you a similar proportional relationship for each reduction. Each incremental reduction gives you a similar proportional reduction, relative reduction, in risk. And that just summarizes it, showing the more versus less trials here and the statin versus control trials here. So for each minimal reduction, there's a 22% risk reduction per minimal. Now again, this looks forbidding. I showed you one very similar to this earlier, showing you the effects per minimal for a reduction in major coronary events, for coronary replumbing, and for stroke. And you'd be forgiven for thinking that I'm showing the same one. I'm not. These lines here, which show you the uncertainty around the estimates, are slightly wider, but the pattern is almost identical. Very reassuring that here we're just looking at five trials comparing more versus less intensive statin therapy, and we're seeing a very similar pattern to the one that we saw for statin versus control. So it makes sense, actually, to put all the trials together. There's no sense in subdividing them, since the relationships appear to be similar when you standardise all reductions in LDL cholesterol. So when we look at all 26 trials together, and we standardise per minimal reduction in LDL cholesterol, we again get this very similar pattern. Pretty much any event that is occlusive results from occlusion of a vessel due to atherosclerosis is presented at about 1/5 per minimal. It's easy enough to remember, except the hemorrhagic stroke. Now that we have much more data, we have almost 25,000 major vascular events, which is an astonishing number of events to be analysing. We can look to see in detail the effects in some categories that have previously been at least debated. What I want to talk about just very briefly is patients with no history of vascular disease, or people with no history of vascular disease. If you look at healthy people, does lowering cholesterol have the same sorts of benefits for a minimal reduction as it does in people with coronary heart disease or other diseases? And the evidence is yes, it does. These points are very much in line with each other, and this point here is highly statistically significant. So around about a 1/5 per minimal reduction is seen in healthy people. In fact, it's quite extraordinary how much data we have just from the more versus less trials, where, as I mentioned to you, the starting LDL cholesterol in people who were on a standard statin regimen was already quite low. And you can see that along the left-hand side here, this is the starting cholesterol. So you saw 3.5 as being the benchmark in the statin versus control trials. Now we're getting down to much, much lower levels. So even among people who started with an LDL cholesterol of less than 2 millimoles, further reduction was associated with benefit. And this is really quite an extraordinary result, because it means that if you've got a high-risk person who's had coronary disease, and you've treated their cholesterol and come down to what would mostly be regarded as a very low cholesterol, further reduction in that LDL cholesterol will give you further benefit. So it's completely overturned this idea that is prevalent, not only in the public's mind, but also in some professionals' minds, that you only treat cholesterol if it's high. So you treat cholesterol if there is an established risk of coronary heart disease. So we're now in the position where standard statin regimens can reduce risk And this is just an example. It doesn't come from any individual analysis. It's an example. If you started off with an LDL around 4, you can reduce it down to around 3 with a standard statin. You can reduce it further by around another half with a more intensive statin regimen. But actually, in some patients, you can give a statin regimen that can reduce LDL cholesterol by 2. And if you did that, you'd expect the reduction in risk to be around 40%. And in fact, in some patients who have, say, cholesterol of 5, to start with, an LDL cholesterol of 5, with some regimens that are available now, you can reduce that by 3 millimoles, or a 60% reduction in risk, 50% reduction in risk. So these are very effective drugs. So I think we've been able to demonstrate that lower is better, but are these regimens safe? That is the big question that we now have to tackle. The first slide I'm showing you now is the effects of LDL lowering, again in all 26 trials that we've recently examined, subdivided by cause of death. So we see the expected effect on cardiac deaths here, a clear benefit on cardiac mortality, and we do not see any definite evidence of any hazard. There isn't any increase in non-vascular deaths. This was the big worry right back in the 80s when there was so much confusion over the early trials involving only small and feeble cholesterol-lowering regimens. This has really provided reassurance that lower cholesterol is not hazardous in terms of an increased risk of non-vascular mortality. There are hazards to cholesterol-lowering drugs, and in particular with statins, we know that there are transient increases in markers that show you that there's some liver damage. But the particular one I want to mention is myopathy, muscle damage. This is a measure of muscle damage. When it gets to 10 times the upper limit of normal level and is accompanied by muscle symptoms, that is called myopathy, and that is something that is a hazard that needs to be avoided. But it's quite rare, less than 1 per 10,000 per year. Rhabdomyolysis is this abnormality, but when it's progressed much further to a very high level and the kidneys have been affected, but that's even less common. We know that statin drugs do increase the risk of these abnormalities. They're generally transient when you stop the drug. But when we're using intensive statins regimens, we need to know that that's not going to cause a problem. Now, I'm not going to share the detailed data of this, but we know that for many of the intensive regimens, there does not appear to be a large excess of muscle damage. But one particular regimen that's been studied, 80 milligrams of simvastatin in the SEARCH trial, did show a very clear evidence of hazard. And so, when allocated to 80 milligrams of simvastatin, you can see the risk was something like 53-3 on 20 milligrams of standard dose. And so this clearly is something that needs to be avoided, if at all possible. So 18 milligrams of simvastatin is probably not the way to go to produce an intensive reduction in LDL cholesterol. What was the cause of this? Well, it appears that most of the episodes were actually caused by a genetic defect. But I wanted to mention one particular cause that is associated with an increased risk of myopathy, and that's renal impairment, because some of my later slides will be about kidney disease, and that's a relevant point to make. Before I go on to that, though, I want to talk about the controversy over low cholesterol and cancer, because this has, again, held people back from prescribing statins freely. There have been many studies showing the relationship between low blood cholesterol and an increased risk of cancer. And the reason for this, I think we now know, is that people who are sick are more likely to develop cancer, and their livers stop making cholesterol, so they also have low cholesterol. So there's an association between the two conditions. There have been some meta-analyses of previous randomized trials, and individual trials, but they've generally been reassuring, but some individual trials have, probably by the play of chance, just shown the blips for breast cancer in one case, gastrointestinal cancer in another. And there have more recently been particular concerns because we're now starting to lower cholesterol right down to very low levels, not previously been possible. Would that increase the risk of cancer? So this is an analysis done by the Prestov Treatment Trialist team here in Oxford, led by John Anderson. And this shows you that when you look at all the trials of statin versus control, the rate ratio here is 1.00. Absolutely, I mean, you can't get more conclusive than that. That's very reassuring. But we wanted to go beyond that. So we asked ourselves, if this type of treatment did cause cancer, I mean, to start with, it would be very unlikely it would cause it within 5 years or so, which is the average length of the trials. But if it did cause cancer, what would we expect to see? Well, we expect that when the LDL levels are reduced the most, the risk would be biggest. We'd expect that the longer the treatment, the more likely it would be that any risk would emerge. And we'd also expect that it wouldn't be a general increase in the risk of cancer, but that's not the way cancer works. You'd expect it just to be one or two sites, specific cancers, that would be increased. So we set out to look at all these questions using the fabulous database that we've accumulated over the years. So here we're looking at the effects of low LDL cholesterol. It's very similar to the slide I showed you earlier. Less than 2, if anything, the line is on the reassuring side. The point estimate is to the left, suggesting that there is no clear evidence of any hazard associated with low LDL cholesterol. Not only for the statin trials, but also for the morbid statin trials. So the next question is, what happens over time? Is there a gradual emergence of risk over time? And we see that if we subdivide the events, the cancer events, by year in which it occurred, you can see that, again, there's no evidence that the risk begins to emerge over time. If anything, the reverse. There's just no evidence that this is causing cancer with increased duration exposure. And finally, we've looked at many more sites that I'm showing on this slide, but I don't want to blind people with too many numbers. What you're seeing here is the numbers of cancers in each type of trial, statin versus control and more versus less statin. And you can see that these numbers are very similar to each other. We really found no evidence that any individual cancer, not only in the statin versus control trials, which involved a reduction from around average level to slightly below average, or even in statin, the more versus less statin trials, which all involved reducing low cholesterol down to a much lower level. So I think that's a very good test of the hypothesis that cholesterol lowering causes cancer. I think we've at least shown that at least within 5 years or so, there was no evidence of any hazard. Indeed, we have longer-term follow-up studies suggesting that no hazard emerges for at least 10 years after the patients go into the studies. So that managed to generate interest from the Daily Express. Journalists love stories that seem to overturn something that had been said before. So statins do not cause cancer, new research studies shows. This is by far the most reliable assessment we have to date. Obviously, more trials will emerge, but I really think that it's unlikely we're going to see any change to the situation. I want to come back to hemorrhagic stroke, because we've known for a long time that the relationship between hemorrhagic stroke and cholesterol there's a suggestion that lower LDL cholesterol is associated with a slightly increased risk of hemorrhagic stroke in the observational studies. But it's taken 170,000 patients randomized into 26 trials, 25,000 major vascular events, and actually, when you look at the numbers, 600 hemorrhagic strokes have emerged in that evidence. It's taken that to show us that there's a marginally significant increased risk of hemorrhagic stroke when you lower LDL cholesterol. But the absolute risk of this, you can see the numbers are so small that the absolute risk of an event is tiny, and would be tiny even if you were giving these statin treatments to people with no other disease. So even if people were healthy, the increased risk of hemorrhagic stroke would be an order of magnitude lower than their benefit. So I think hemorrhagic stroke, whilst it may be real, it's not an issue for people, even if they're healthy. to summarise, if we're predicting benefits, the previous slides, I think, have shown you that the size of the benefit depends on the absolute reduction in LDL cholesterol. The larger the reduction, the larger the benefit. But it also depends on the absolute risks of events that can be prevented. So if you have a group of patients who are largely not going to have coronary events or ischemic strokes, then they're not going to benefit. It seems obvious, but actually it's relevant to interpreting some of the evidence. If you have a group of patients with terminal cancer, they're not going to have enough coronary events to benefit from statin therapy. So I want to just mention in passing a couple of trials, two trials that were done in patients with heart failure. These patients with heart failure are very sick, and many of them are going to die very quickly. But they're going to die of their hearts giving up, and they're going to die of an arrhythmia. They're not mainly going to die from coronary obstruction. And so around two-thirds of deaths in these trials were... around two-thirds of the primary endpoints of these trials were actually death due to one of the causes that cannot be influenced by reducing cholesterol. So it shouldn't be any surprise to anyone that these trials were negative. They failed to show a reduction in their primary endpoint, the thing that was chosen as the marker of benefit. This does not mean that lowering cholesterol in these patients wouldn't be conferring some benefit if these trials were large enough to show it. It's just that the numbers of events that can be reduced are so small within that morass of other causes of death that it can't be demonstrated by trials of this size. And this is an illustration of the comparison between the proportions of different causes of death in all the database we had, where 42% of deaths were due to coronary disease, and of course we showed a clear benefit on those deaths, whereas in the heart failure trials, only 2% were due to coronary heart disease. And we had all these deaths, heart failure, sudden death and arrhythmia, causing most of the burden of mortality. So these patients might have a small absolute benefit, we simply don't know from the available trials. Now, for the last part of my talk, I want to talk about our work on chronic kidney disease. And I want to mention in particular, this work has been done in conjunction with Martin Landry, who's also in the audience. Without which none of this would happen, so I'm very grateful to him for his help. The epidemiology of cardiovascular disease in patients who've got bad enough disease to need dialysis or kidney machine is very interesting. If we look at the general population, healthy people with no evidence of chronic kidney disease, and as they get older, of course their risk of dying from cardiovascular disease increases, and it increases in a logarithmic way. So this line here is 10 times lower than this line, and so on. So when you're young, you're basically not going to die of cardiovascular disease unless you're unlucky. In dialysis patients, the risk of dying from such a disease in young people is about 1,000-fold higher. So this is an extraordinary piece of epidemiology. It's really very rarely seen anything like this. And this tells you that cardiovascular disease develops highly prematurely in people who have chronic kidney disease. It's not caused by the dialysis process. It's caused by having failed kidneys. And recognising that this was an issue that hadn't really been tackled, working with Martin, we worked out that what we need to do is try and think about ways that we can reverse cardiovascular risk. And the obvious candidate to us was reducing LDL cholesterol. So we put together an argument for this, and these are the arguments. If you look at cardiovascular disease in people with kidney disease, it's uncertain what it really is. I mean, yes, you get coronary heart disease, but you also have flabby hearts, you have stiff arteries, you have heart failure, and sudden death is a very common cause of demise. So there was some uncertainty at the beginning whether lowering cholesterol would actually work in terms of reducing risk. Perhaps because of that, the associations between cholesterol and risk were very unclear, perhaps because some of the deaths actually weren't due to coronary heart disease. And we didn't have any good evidence at that time. These patients are quite sick, and they're generally excluded from trials because people are concerned about side effects, but mainly. So there was uncertainty, and we came up with a plan to reduce LDL cholesterol. We knew from the epidemiology, and increasingly we were aware from the trials, that even though these patients don't have high LDL cholesterol, they're at high risk. So our trials tell us that reducing LDL cholesterol from normal to low should provide benefit. Now, high statin doses would have been one possibility to give in this group of patients, but we were very concerned about safety. We were concerned, as I showed you earlier in the SEARCH trial, although that wasn't available then, there was some evidence that high statin doses would cause accumulation of the statins in people who couldn't clear the drug because they had kidney disease, and that would cause a problem. And so a possible solution was to use a moderate dose of a statin plus another drug that can reduce cholesterol in an entirely different way and wouldn't have problems with accumulation. And so this is what we did. I already showed you about the statin, but it's also possible to block the absorption of cholesterol from the gut, which is one component of the way in which cholesterol gets into LDL cholesterol. So a combination of statin and this drug called ezetimibe, which inhibits absorption of cholesterol, was, we thought, a way we could give a moderate dose of a statin, and so have a safe dose of a statin, but get a large LDL cholesterol reduction by using something else that wouldn't have the toxicity of a high dose of a statin. We did a couple of pilot studies. LDL cholesterol in these two pilot studies was shown over time. The first pilot study was a placebo control study. So this is placebo in the red here. And by 12 months, we had shown that we could reduce LDL cholesterol by around about 0.9 millimoles, just less than a millimole. So when we realized that it was going to be possible to add in ezetimibe, we did another pilot study. And then we compared simvastatin 20 milligrams, one of the regimens that had available in the orange, and then we added in ezetimibe in the blue and got a further reduction. So we ended up with around about 1.2 or 1.3 millimoles reduction by using the combination. And this gave us what we needed, a large LDL cholesterol reduction, which we thought would be safe. And then it sounds simple. We came up with this plan, 9,000 patients with chronic kidney disease. Two-thirds of them we thought we had before the need for dialysis, because that's a much larger group of patients in the scheme of things. Most people don't get to dialysis because they die before it. We aimed to have, over the average of the study, a 1 millimole reduction, and we predicted that we'd get around about a 20% reduction in coronary events, or in what we call major atherosclerotic events, if we did that. The trial went on for around 4 years, and the event that we were interested in was all those things that the trials told us would be reduced by lowering cholesterol. So we stripped out things that we thought wouldn't be affected by LDL cholesterol and just focused on those things that we thought would be. So the endpoint was was non-fatal heart attack or coronary death, stroke caused by a blood clot, and any revascularization, any replumbing, whether it was in the coronary vessels or somewhere else in the body. And that was the result. And actually, one of the great moments in my career, I'm sure Martin's, when we stood up and showed this to a room of 3,000 skeptical nephrologists who spontaneously broke into applause. This is something, really something for kidney patients. But all we did was follow the epidemiology. We followed the epidemiology and tried to ensure that we stuck to the messages we were getting from the data, to try to ensure that we got good compliance. We didn't get good compliance, but we got good enough compliance with treatment to get a result. We were concerned about safety. That was the whole point of doing this with the combination of simvastatin and ezetimibe. But actually, when we looked at the incidence of myopathy, there wasn't really any good evidence of any excess risk of, even though we know we expect 20 milligrams of simvastatin to increase the risk slightly, we didn't have good evidence of it from our study. We didn't have any evidence either that any of these other things that go wrong when you lower cholesterol or do it interfere with gut absorption, none of these things really turned out to be a problem. So we ended up with a very sick group of patients who could get a large reduction in their bad cholesterol by taking combination therapy. sounds simple, like I said before, but actually this has been an enormous amount of work over many years. And one of the things that almost tripped us up was that whilst we were doing the trial, a study in patients with aortic stenosis called the C study, again using combination therapy, suggested in a really a tertiary analysis, or even an analysis that hadn't been planned beforehand, that there might be an excess risk of cancer. So 101 cancers versus 65 on control regimen. And this caused big problems because people were worried that this might be real and that this would interfere with their ability to use ezetimibe. So we responded by putting together, Richard led the work, we put together the evidence from what was already available in the SHARP study and another big study that was going on, looking at a slightly different question, but also relevant to the question. So we put together the evidence from these two trials and we came up with very reassuring data, 313 versus 326. Was it good evidence that this hypothesis generated by the C study wasn't supported by the hypothesis testing studies, SHARP and IMPROVE IT? And this allowed us to continue with the study. The regulatory agencies were reassured by this and were able to continue. And then when we got to the end of the study and looked at the overall risk of cancer in the two arms, using much more data, because of course that involved the whole of the study, we found no evidence of any difference in cancer risk. And in fact, I mean, you can see that they overlap, and you can't see, because it's too small, but you can't see that there are no excesses of any individual cancer that we examine. So that, I think, summarises where we've got to. First of all, lower is better. Even in people with normal or low cholesterol, lower is better. Because how you achieve it? You can achieve it with high-dose statin regimens, or if there are concerns about safety, there's a possibility of doing it with a combination of standard statin regimen and ezetimibe. But in fact, really, more is better. It suggests that we should be going much further than that. We should be saying, well, actually, we're not really doing well enough with patients who are high risk. We should push it as far as we can. What about using high-dose statins and ezetimibe? These are the questions for the future. But that is what is argued by the results of these trials. And in particular, I think that the evidence has been arguing for considering this in anyone who's at high risk of cardiovascular disease. Kidney patients actually have more of a problem from cardiac disease that is not related to coronary disease. But they still have enough coronary disease to benefit clearly from lowering cholesterol. So we've been able to show that clearly. I want to close with this slide, which shows you the extraordinary impact that cigarette smoking cessation, blood pressure management, and other public health interventions have had over the years. And more recently, widespread use of LDL lowering therapy has continued to push down the risks of coronary heart disease and ischemic stroke among middle-aged people and also in elderly people. It's very clear to see from these WHO statistics. And I think it's a fitting point to end on a very important topic that I still think is not particularly well understood by practicing doctors. And I want to close by acknowledging the enormous amount of help I've had over the years. Obviously, Richard and Rory have been very important, but Martin in particular has been very important working with me on the SHARP study and also just generally supporting anything that we've been doing together. I've had great support from the Vascular Overview team. I think some of them are in the room. Jonathan Emerson in particular, who's worked generally on statistics on both SHARP and Vascular Overviews. And the SHARP team, these people, but many, many others, not only in CTSU but around the world. I think, Martin, we calculated that over 1,000 people have worked on SHARP to get this result. It's been a very, very enjoyable time, and thank you very much.